Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference presented by Matt Tolbert, Information Security Officer at the University of Pittsburgh. The session is entitled, Implementing a Successful Student Records Authorization Process.
Our speaker today is Matt Tolbert from the University of Pittsburgh. And they give me a bio here that's printed in 0.7 type. So I'm not sure that I can read all of this because I'm a little bit older. He's the Information Security Officer at the University of Pittsburgh. And he's been serving in a significant role developing and implementing security risk management for several years. I had breakfast with him this morning, and he mentioned to me to let you know that while at work, he is security averse. Outside of work, he prefers climbing mountains. So here he is, speaking to us with his colleagues about implementing a successful student records authorization process.
Good afternoon, everyone. Let me suggest this, especially since I had a chance to meet a lot of you already, and I know the ones in the back, you're all troublemakers. So I want to encourage everyone to move forward. Some of the slides we're going to show here are going to have some detail that will be hard to see if you're sitting in the back. So come on up. Once again, my name is Matt Tolbert. I serve as the Information Security Officer for the University of Pittsburgh. I've been in that role for nearly 4 years. Before that, I was in the consulting world. I had worked with several different firms over the past 12, 15 years, like PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young, in the New York City area, where I focused on implementing ERP systems like PeopleSoft, Oracle Financials, and SAP R3. Then I came to academia about 4 years ago. My timing, I think, was coincidental, because one of the reasons why I came into academia was to actually get away from doing big ERP implementations, these big PeopleSoft, SAP R3 application implementations. When I started doing that, I had a full set of hair. By the time I was done 10 years later, no hair left. But as you'll see, I came just when the university was rolling out its new PeopleSoft student record system package, and got involved with the implementation of security controls as part of that rollout. So that's really what this presentation is about today. We're going to share with you some of the stories and work that we did to implement an authorization process for that PeopleSoft student record system program that ensured that only the right people had the right access to data in that system. By the way, I know a lot of you probably use the Banner system. How many of you use Banner at your university? How many of you use PeopleSoft? How many of you use something else? Okay. Although we use PeopleSoft, this authorization process we're going to cover this afternoon is really applicable to any kind of student record system. So if you're using Banner, your own custom design, homegrown application, the process is applicable to any kind of ERP system that's available out there. Before I get started, too, I want to introduce you to two people. With me is my colleague, Kelly Smith. Kelly is a senior security analyst with the University of Pittsburgh, and she is, I have to give her credit. Actually, I have to give you all the credit. It was really Kelly who was instrumental in implementing this federated authorization process you're going to see today. She's been fantastic. And also with us today is our lead technologist, Jay Graham. If you have any really in-depth questions during the course of this presentation, I may actually defer them to Jay. Jay is definitely our person who has that technical depth. Speaking of questions, by the way, I think to respect everyone's time, what I'd like to suggest is if you have questions, if you could hold off until the end of the presentation and then ask your questions, I'd greatly appreciate it. Also, Kelly, myself, and hopefully Jay will be able to stay around afterwards, too, if you want to come up and talk with us a little bit more about our implementation of federated authorization. Okay, we're ready to get started? So what our agenda over the next 45 to 50 minutes is going to be is really talking about a little bit about the University of Pittsburgh and our student record system. Then I'm going to dive right into some of the problems and challenges we had as we started to roll out the new PeopleSoft system as these challenges applied to security. And then really focus on the solution that we came up with and show you examples of some of the tools and the processes we put in place to make this a success. So first, a little bit about the University of Pittsburgh, some statistics. We've been around for a very long time. We are a very large school with a very large campus, over 100 buildings scattered across Oakland, which is just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Very large faculty base, over 12,000 employees, including 3,800 faculty members, and over 34,000 currently enrolled students. We also have a serious number of different departments and schools, undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools, like our School of Medicine. In fact, we have six health science schools associated with our School of Medicine. We also have four regional campuses in addition to our main campus. So I'd like to show this metric just to show that we have a very large customer base that we have to serve in terms of faculty, staff, and students. Our financials, by the way, are also pretty significant, too. We're over $1.3 billion a year in terms of our annual budget. Much of that comes from R&D-related funding we receive from the National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation. We also have a very large endowment, a large amount of assets. And we have key partnerships with two groups that you may have heard of, one being the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, not directly affiliated with the University of Pittsburgh. It's sort of a sister organization. And also the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center, which you may have heard of if you do anything in the way of research computing. So our new student record system. When I joined the university about 4 years ago, they were in the process of retiring their old mainframe, in-house developed system called ISIS, and converting over to a new system called our student record system, SRS. And they had chosen PeopleSoft as the package to implement this new student record system. The implementation time frame, it really started in about 2003, although there was considerable planning even before 2003 in terms of selection of the package, planning the rollout, migration of data, all those key tasks in terms of going to a new student record system. It was a three-year project starting in 2003, going to 2005. They had a beautiful, quiet rollout. Having done ERP implementations for over 10 years, I probably have done six major ones. The best ones are the ones the day that you go live, it's quiet. No one's calling, no one's panicking, everyone's just using the new system, and it's business as usual. And we had that when we went live. We did do a major upgrade in 2007 to version 8.9, which I think is one of the most recent versions of PeopleSoft available. And this semester, starting this fall semester, we implemented our new student self-registration capability. So now for the first time, our students are starting to be able to go directly into the student record system and register for classes. Now, in talking with some of you today, I know that several of you have either a system where all of your student records are contained in one application, or in other cases, you've got different student records scattered across multiple applications. Well, the university really made an effort to try and centralize all data into one application, that being PeopleSoft. So if you look today at all the capabilities that PeopleSoft provides to the university environment, this box right here shows a list of all those types of student records that we maintain on our SRS system. So that's everything from recruiting and admission to core student records, such as your class schedule, grades, things like that, financial aid information, student financial information in terms of whether they have to pay their bill or not, very important, even academic advisement related information. A lot of information centralized in one system. And let me just show you a couple of screenshots in terms of what this PeopleSoft student record system looks like. To get access to PeopleSoft, you actually go through our portal environment. We have a web-based portal system and called my.pitt.edu. And what's great about my.pitt.edu is it provides a single sign-on service to the university environment. You don't need a separate user ID and password to get into PeopleSoft. Once you're logged into our portal environment, you're granted access to a variety of different services, including PeopleSoft. So what I would do here for this particular case is log onto the portal, and then all I would have to do is click on this little button right here, log on to PeopleSoft, and boom, I'm right into the system, and I can start doing my work. Here's a sample screenshot, just a simple page within PeopleSoft showing a standard record, student information record, just personal data about the student, the student's campus ID, date of birth, social security number. Here's another sample shot showing the grade point average and grades in individual classes of a particular student that's stored in PeopleSoft. Now, hopefully, as you see this information, especially if you're a security professional, and I know there's some security professionals here in the audience, you're going to start thinking immediately, wow, that's sensitive information. You know, it's something we've got to protect. And you're absolutely right, because one of the big challenges we saw early on as we implemented the new PeopleSoft system was there's a lot of sensitive data stored in the system. And this has to be true, I think, for all of your organizations as well with your student record systems. You have sensitive information such as Social Security numbers, financial records, could be bank account information associated with financial aid applications. Interesting for us, we do not keep credit card numbers in our student record system, which helps us definitely in terms of PCI compliance. We don't really have to comply with PCI for our system because we don't maintain it locally. But I do know other universities do maintain credit card information in their student record systems. So that's sensitive information you have to be cognizant of. Admission status, you know, basically the status, are you a currently registered student or not? Have you taken a leave of absence for whatever reason? We have that kind of information there. Academic records, of course, grade information, graduation status. Admission status and academic records, I mean, this is sensitive information because even though it's not necessarily something as sensitive as you would say like Social Security numbers, this is information you still want to make sure that is not publicly disclosed. And that's not just because of regulations like FERPA. That's also, quite frankly, in terms of maintaining the privacy of your students. There have been incidents with other organizations where someone's been able to get into a student record system and see, for example, the grade point average of, say, one of your star athletes, which may not be so good, and that information gets out to the media. Right? That's a breach of a personal, private information that you really don't want to have with your systems. Finally, class schedules. Now, this is kind of surprising in terms of class schedules being considered sensitive information. I think one of the things that security professionals in academia are starting to realize is, unfortunately, if some people can get access to a student's class schedule to know where that student is, they can become potentially a victim of harassment. We have definitely seen this already, not with student record systems, but of all places with MySpace and Facebook, where students are putting up detailed information as to where they're going to be, what party they're going to. Here's my class schedule for this semester. And people are taking advantage of that information to literally, in some cases, stalk students because that information is accessible. So we do consider class schedules to be sensitive information, not to be generally disclosed to anyone in the campus community, let alone certainly the public. So once again, why we kind of have these risks of protecting sensitive information here is for reasons of everything from, as we were talking about, confidentiality, compliance with regulations like FSMA, FERPA, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, PCI, data integrity. Obviously, you don't want to have people be able to get into your student record system and do things like change grades from an F to an A. Okay, and I think we've all heard stories about things that have happened to certain organizations where, because they didn't have good authorization controls in place, that has happened. And finally, the one I want to talk a little bit more about in detail is identity theft. Hopefully, everyone is cognizant about how serious the issue of identity theft is in this day and age. It is the fastest growing crime in the world right now. And it's definitely being driven not by individuals, as we kind of saw 8 to 10 years ago, but now by organized crime. Organizations that know how to take the information, use the information, and exploit the information for financial gain. Interesting metric. According to the FBI, as early as 2006, identity theft each year netted about $100 billion globally. Another metric I don't have on the slide here, average take of each identity theft incident, just one incident, could be like a computer breach, it could be someone actually picking up records in a book that was left on someone's desk, average take, $100,000 per incident. To put that in perspective, that's more money than the global illicit trade in drugs is making right now. You can make more money in identity theft than you can selling drugs. And even better, typically, when you're doing identity theft, lesser chance of getting shot at. So not only is it more lucrative, but it's safer. And criminals, are, of course, seeking Social Security numbers, credit card and bank account numbers, user IDs and passwords. They love user IDs and passwords because once they have your user ID and password, they've got the keys of the kingdom in terms of your bank accounts. If you're trading stocks online, like with E-Trade, they can get into your account there and clean you out. Just an example there, I had a friend about 2 years ago whose user ID and password to E-Trade was compromised. And not only did that person who got that user ID and password clean out his account in the order of like $20,000 to $30,000 worth of stocks. But even after he tried to resolve the issue with E-Trade, he got hit with the capital gains by the IRS the next year because that guy had sold his stocks, but it was still attributed to him. And the fastest growing area in terms of identity theft right now is health insurance IDs. Any kind of information in terms of your health care policy. That's definitely a big one. And just have a screenshot here. It is amazing in the security profession to go out and see how many of these different types of websites, online chat rooms, kind of Web 2.0 blog types of solutions out there from across the world make it easy once you get that information, those social security numbers and things like that, credit card numbers, how easy it is to post it and sell it online. This is a screenshot from one service called Carter Planet that operated out in the open for about 3 years, based in Russia, where they provided a service, kind of a common ground for people who had stolen sensitive information and essentially could charge fees. Like, here's an example, Visa. If you got a Visa Classic credit card number, they'll pay $35 per number. If you got American Express, we'll give you $50 per one. If you got Discovery Platinum, $100 per record. And then what you would have to do is on these sites is you would match up these service providers, these, for example, hackers who were able to compromise the system, get these records and information, post it here, and then, you would have other buyers. It wouldn't have to be a hacker, just someone who knows how to take that information and exploit it for purposes of identity theft. Now, why do I mention this? Because, quite frankly, student record systems are a wealth of sensitive personal information that can be used for identity theft. So it's very, very important to have strong authorization controls and other security controls on these systems, because most hackers nowadays are very clever, they're smart, they like to go where the information is. It's kind of like the old saying, you know, why do you rob a bank? Well, that's where the money is. Why do hackers go after student record systems? That's where the information is. So security, I think everyone gets the point. Very important for student record system. Hey, is everyone feeling good and paranoid now? All right, then I've done my job. That's the paranoia part of the presentation. So here are the things we needed to consider when we were rolling out security controls and authorization controls for the student record system. First of all, number one key thing you have to keep in mind is you want to make sure that your access to your student record system is limited by your functional need. You should only allow access to an individual based on what their job responsibilities are. If their job requires access to certain key information, give it to them. If they don't require that access, make sure they don't have that access. A lot of the problems we see nowadays in terms of security incidents, security breaches, and things like that are because someone had too much free access to information that they shouldn't have had in the first place. Separation of duties is the second thing. Someone who approves access into a student record system should not necessarily be a user of the system, particularly, quite frankly, if it's a faculty member. It's too easy for someone who's an authorizer, who is also a user, to kind of try to circumvent security controls to make their life a little easier. And we have seen this in the past with regards to people asking for, I want access to all student grade information, for example, even though I just need access to grades for my particular department, but I want it for everything. Why? Because we're curious. I want to see how people are doing overall in terms of their grades. You really want to make sure that you designate only impartial individuals who can actually designate access privileges to your student record system. And third and final, grouped areas of need. You want to make sure that your student record system has the ability to localize access to information primarily based on departmental structure. All right? I'll give you a couple examples. Our regional branch campus, Titusville, does not need to see the student records of someone at the Bradford regional campus. Someone in our English department does not need to see necessarily the student records of someone in our engineering department. One of the things I've come to learn talking with my colleagues as to why this is so important, one of the things I didn't realize is sometimes departments can be very competitive when it comes to trying to get students to come to their department, especially if these students have really great grades. I know of one example where there's a university where they have performance metrics, of which a key metric indicator is the GPA average of the students in their department. So what happened was when this was put into place, these departments got smart. They were able to go into their student record system where they had access to everyone's student grades. And they started doing all these queries looking for who has the top grades. And they would go out and they would actually try to actively recruit those students to come to their department. Well, as you can imagine, that causes a whole host of different issues. First of all, quite frankly, you're not serving the student well. You're not addressing the student's needs and desires in terms of what academic field, for example, they should be going into or want to go into. Instead, you're literally trying to pressure them to go into another area, not because you're trying to help them. You're just trying to get your metric up to a higher GPA. They finally clamped down on it because it became so political and so controversial that they stopped that metric practice and then took the additional step of putting additional security controls in place to make sure that you couldn't do those kind of queries anymore in their student record system. So that was kind of a general overview. Now I want to dive a little bit into what we actually implemented at the University of Pittsburgh. And the way we've kind of organized this information is into the classic people, process, and technology, three spheres of influence. So let me dive right into the first part of the solution, technology, which is really just making sure that our student record system had the ability to control who could see what information in our student record system. So we were able really to address the key question, how do you ensure that only authorized users have the ability to egress student records applicable only to their work responsibilities? And the way we accomplished that, I looked at Kelly once again in terms of one of the key things that she was able to accomplish when she joined us, as well as other members of the security team, was we first looked at, well, what are the specific needs and constraints with regards to data authorization access? And what we did was we actually found out, well, yeah, there's a variety of different types of administrator-level users who would need administrator-level access to data. And these are the numbers involving the types of users and the number of users for each of these areas. So admissions, enrollment, student financial, instructor self-service users. Hopefully, by the way, you can see why this is kind of nice how this is broken out. Arguably, someone who's responsible for admissions should not need to see student financial information, not part of their job responsibilities. Maybe true in terms of someone from student financials may need access to information with regards to admission status. But this is essentially how we kind of broke things down in terms of these defined user groups. Then what we did was, in the PeopleSoft system, we identified the types of specific data permissions that are needed. And we came up with 253 permission lists, or what they called in PeopleSoft, types of permissions in terms of the types of information you can see within our student record systems. From those permission lists, we could then build what are called security roles. And all a security role really does is it defines someone's job responsibilities. It says, this person, say, in the registrar's office, should have this and this and this and this permission associated with them to see this kind of data. So we create a kind of role like that. Now, for those of you involved with authorizations, let me give you a little tip. This comes from my days when I used to do a little bit of IT audit. One of the things that auditors love to look for is they look for security roles. They'll ask you, how many defined security roles do you have in your system? If you say that you have, say, about 70, 80, 100 or so, and you can show them that you actually have 70, 80, 100, that's a good sign. It means that you have gone through the exercise of identifying roles that associate with job responsibilities. If you have only, say, 3 or 4 or 5 security roles, you're in trouble. Because a good IT auditor will immediately say, that's too broad. You've got roles that are way too broad. Because you have to be in any kind of organization, whether it's a business organization, academic organization, there are a lot of different people with a lot of different responsibilities. You can't have a minimum of 2 or 3 or 4 and not expect to have too much in the way of broad access. So 3 or 4 or 5 security roles is a red flag. If you don't have any security roles, you are really in trouble. Because that means your system is wide open to everyone. And you're susceptible to things like what we call the Yahoo effect. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Yahoo effect. It's if you give someone too much permissions on a system so they can start doing things to the system, they can literally bring the system down. I learned this term, the Yahoo effect, my first ERP implementation was an SAP R3 implementation. And the CFO insisted that he wanted full access to all financial-related functionality in their record system. And he was loving it. As soon as the system came up, he started playing with it, learning with it. And then he wrote and he executed the mother of all queries. He literally queried every single financial system. Now keep in mind, this company had just implemented this SAP R3 system. The entire company depended on the system to run functionally. The CFO launched that one query and brought the entire system down. It's just so overloaded, overtaxed the system in terms of that query that everything stopped. They couldn't move things out of their warehouse. They couldn't do invoice and billing. everything stopped. So we call it the Yahoo effect. Person goes in, has so much access, so much control, they go Yahoo, and they blow up the machine. So that's technology. The next part, of course, is people, very important. And what we did was we designated security contacts. Let me explain to you why we did that. A lot of times what I've seen in the past is, especially on the business side, you've got a security team that is responsible for security authorizations. So all requests come to the security team. Typically, that's not a good idea. It's not a good practice. Because what happens is you get all these different folks out here requesting typically a small group of people, one, two, three people maybe at most, for access. And your security team, your authorization team, typically these are IT people. They have no idea in terms of if this person here is asking for access to your general ledger account or, say, from a student financial system standpoint, grades to a certain department. We don't know if that's an appropriate request or not. Okay? We're computer people. So it leads to a lot of confusion, and not to mention a very heavy workload when you do that. So our solution was to designate security contacts, or in our case, departmental-level security contacts. We wanted to make sure that every single academic department, as well as other operational departments within the university, like our human resources department, had a designated security contact who essentially would be responsible for approving access into our student record system. So what we did was we asked each department to designate a security contact. Now, very key, we said this person must be a departmental administrator. Essentially, it has to be staff, has to be someone with a certain level of authority within the department. The person was not allowed to be a secretary, was not allowed to be a faculty member because of separation of duty issues, and could not be your local IT support professional because, once again, they're IT people. They know computers, they know technology, but they don't necessarily know academic and business processes. So we had our departments designate people, and we came up with about 50 security contacts, all who had to go through mandatory training to understand what their responsibilities were and how to use this process we were setting up for authorizations. So just to visualize, once again, what we did, now instead of that big kind of curve of all these individual users going directly to the security team, now each department, folks could go to their designated security contact, who would then forward on approved requests to the security team. Much, much better situation. And I don't know if you saw that or not. You know, certainly made the security team very happy. So the responsibilities of security contact, well, the key one, of course, is reviewing and approving any kind of request for administrative level access into our student record system. But we also gave them two additional responsibilities. We gave them the responsibility on a yearly basis to go through and review who currently has administrative access to your system. Now, this is a key thing that everyone should do, not just for your student record system, but for any computer system that you have. It could be, for example, your file systems. It could be if you have Unix systems, you know, who has administrative access to your Unix system. Once a year on a formal basis, you really should go through and see who currently has access. We did this for the first time last year, and sure enough, we found three or four accounts of people who essentially had moved on to other job responsibilities and should no longer have the access they had in our PeopleSoft system. So because we did this formal review, we caught that, and we were able to retire those permissions. So we depend on the security contacts once a year to get together and do that. And finally, the security contact is responsible for helping to troubleshoot users within that department, any kind of questions or issues that come up with regards to access to the student record system. So instead of flooding our help desk or flooding the security team with questions, they can work locally with the security contact to work those things out. I have some photos I want to share with you. These are photos of the first training session we did with our security contacts more than a year ago. This is Kelly, along with our two other authorization security professionals, Harry Novicki and Jerry Flota. By the way, Harry Novicki, I wish every university organization had a gentleman like Harry Novicki. Harry's been with the university for over 40 years. And he is fantastic as an authorization professional because he knows everyone on campus. And he knows what people are responsible for. So Harry has saved the university time and time again of people who try to get access to student records. And Harry's like, no, I know you. It's not your responsibility. No, you can't do that. I mean, he's been in the university so long, it's easy for him to say no and to explain why he's saying no. He's been a fantastic resource for us. So here's Kelly actually giving the presentation, the training. Here's some of the students involved with that training. Then, of course, there's the annual authorization review. Now, for this, to make this successful, here's what we did. We didn't mandate that security contacts had to get together and do this authorization review. We enticed them using food. And it worked brilliantly. We got nearly, I think we got pretty much everyone. Only one or two people didn't make it. We offered them a free lunch, told them, come down for an hour. We had pre-printed up all the lists of people who currently have access, administrative access, for their department. And while they were eating, they were going through the lists and trying to find, you know, oh, this person, this person, this person, this is okay. Oh, what's George doing on here? George shouldn't be on the list. They would circle that, give it back to us, and then we would take care of it. It worked brilliantly. And we, once again, got good turnout because we offered them food. And here they are eating. One of the great resources we did for our security contacts in our portal environment, we have a dedicated portal page for the security contacts. It has all the information in terms of training materials, the forms and checklists, which I'll be showing to you shortly. Everything is centrally located on this portal page just for security contacts. Easy to access, easy to use. The benefits of using security contacts, now that we've been doing this for well over a year, definitely reduced the workload on our security team. We can now not only focus better on requests that come our way, but we have faster turnaround time. So you don't have to wait a week or two to have an authorization approval done. We can usually do it. How fast do we usually do it, Kelly? Same day. Yeah, same day service. Our security contacts are great, too, because since they're there in the department, typically they know the members of the department. They know their job responsibilities, and they're also aware of when exceptional issues come up that need to be considered. Long story short, since they know the people within their department, they can tell pretty quickly if someone requesting access to our PeopleSoft system, if it's an appropriate access or they're up to some shenanigans. It also helped the security contacts, too, in terms of just remembering who has administrative privileges. Some people have been granted privileges for a very long time, and sometimes people forget that, you know, Sally over here has the ability to do these kind of queries or see this kind of information. So having the security contact involved locally helps remind them in terms of these people who have this legacy access. And finally, it's been a great benefit in terms of our customers, particularly the faculty. Instead of the faculty calling the help desk and then being escalated to our security contact, our security team and all, they can just walk down the hall and they can find that security contact and talk with them directly and promptly to get their issues resolved. So we've had a lot of positive feedback about this process from the faculty because they have that local security contact to rely on. And finally, process, the third part here. And this is our formal federated authorization process. Our federated authorization process, it's brilliant because it's a systemic approach. It's a consistent approach for how we handle any kind of request for access to our student record system. Unfortunately, when I talk to a lot of folks in other universities, one of the biggest challenges they have is, you know, for one department, we have one type of approval process. For another department, we have another type of approval department. For a third type of department or request, they don't even go through us. They just go right to my boss. You know, my boss takes care of it. And that causes problems in terms of consistency and ensuring that you've got appropriate security controls in place. So we have a systemic process for doing really the following things in terms of anyone who wants to add data to our systems, modify data in our systems, who want to be able to run reports, do queries, and the big one, view global data. Someone who wants to be able to see all students' grades, for example. So what we did essentially is, with this process approach, is we federated the responsibility by distributing control to local authorizers. That's the security contacts we just spoke about. And just make sure I'm clear on what federated means. You know, this is what you didn't want to have, not federated. People going directly to the security team. This is federated. Responsibility has been delegated out to these local security contacts within your departments. Why federated authorization? There's definitely some good security control reasons why you want to have it. It's a formal and documented approval process. You know, auditors love to make sure that you have a paper trail in terms of who has access to things. But I think we've also found, too, we've had to do some investigations or people asking historical questions. Why does Sally have this access? Why was it given to her 2-3 years ago? Well, we've got the paper trail. We've got the paperwork to actually show, well, that's because her supervisor at the time authorized her to have this access. Also, it's great, too, because we have all requests go through our Remedy Help Desk ticketing system. So we have the ability to track progress in terms of requests, especially for the special ones that can take maybe sometimes a couple of days, and folks need an update with regards to what's happening with their requests. They can see that in the Remedy system. And Remedy allows us to pull metrics to actually be able to see how many requests we're dealing with on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis. It addresses security control requirements, as we talked before about, separation of duties, audit trail, ensuring data access reflects job responsibilities. And then other benefits that came up too. Time savings. With this process, we were able, from a capacity standpoint, to handle a lot more requests from our users than we were with the pre-federated approach. We're now averaging, I think, between 100 to 200 requests a month. With the prior process that we had in place, you know, there's no way we could have had same-day service with that volume of tickets coming in. Now we do have that ability. We were able to consistently grant access privileges, which not only was that systemic approach, but it greatly reduced the types of errors in processing requests. And then finally, request flexibility. We were able to be faster at, say, creating a new security role for someone because they had special needs because of this process. This is the process flowchart we have for federated authorization. It's complex and has very tiny font. So I'm going to show you more of a conceptualized process approach here. Really what happens is, say you're an end user, you're a faculty member, and you want to be able to provide, have additional capabilities to see the grades or enter grades for students in a particular class. So you can put that request through by filling out our standardized form, which you then have your supervisor sign off on, and then you go to the security contact and present that request to the security contact. Security contact will work with that individual, like this faculty member, to ensure the request is complete and all the information is ready to go. And then they will submit that, if it's approved, to our security team, which will then review it, make sure that, once again, everything is appropriate, all the information that is needed is there in the form. And then if it's approved, we go into the PeopleSoft system and we grant that privilege, that access. Final step is we contact the local security contact. By the way, this is a key step. We don't directly contact the end user. We contact the security contact. Here's the reason why. We receive these request forms not in person. They're faxed to us. Okay. So if someone wanted to be really clever and forge signatures in the form, they could do that. They can get away with that. So to prevent that step from happening, what we do is when we approve the access, we then notify the security contact. It's a way of double-checking to make sure, hey, you know, Bob, that request that you put in yesterday is done, and your user is ready to go. What we don't want to hear is Bob saying, I didn't put a request in. All right. So that's a chance for us to actually catch that kind of shenanigans that can sometimes go on. How we implemented the process, how we kicked it off. As I mentioned before, we designated security contacts for each university area. We also identify data owners, very important. There's going to be some times when there's going to be special requests that a security contact is not going to be able to answer. And it really deals with how you use globalized information. So what we wanted to make sure of is that we had data owners, folks who actually have direct ownership and can make significant decisions in terms of who can have access to information. So, for example, with the registrar's office, Sam Conti is our vice chancellor with regards to all student records. So if you want to basically do some sort of major query, have major access to student records, you have to have Sam Conti or someone, one of Sam Conti's staff members review and authorize that request before it's approved. We developed a simple user access form as well as a checklist form, and I'll show you what this looked like in a second. And then through the course of the process, developing the process, we came up with 5 security checkpoints. Which have been beneficial in terms of catching problems or inappropriate requests for access. Now, here's a shot in terms of what the user form looks like. It's pretty straightforward, and we like it that way. It starts off at the top, just your contact information. In the middle here talks a little bit in terms of what your need request is and information like what your academic center is, what campus are you from, are you from one of our regional campuses or our main campus, also your employment status. Are you faculty? Are you staff? Are you a contractor? particularly a contractor, those are the ones we do kind of want to be careful of knowing about and how we authorize information to essentially someone who's a third party, not directly affiliated with the university. We want to know that information straight up. And then here in the bottom, you have all the approval signatures. You have the requester's signature, your supervisor's signature, the security contact signature. And then when our security team signs off on the request, we also sign this document as well as a record in terms of we reviewed and approved it. Here's our signature. Having the signature is important, by the way, too, because here in this small font, we also have a policy statement down here which says, with my signature, I affirm I have read and understood university computing information and data policies, so on, et cetera, et cetera. When you sign on this document, you acknowledge that you will adhere to university policies as to how you use and manage this data. So it's another way of having a record and raising security awareness to folks when they get access to our systems. And this is a checklist. This is Kelly's work here, which I'm really impressed with. This has made the lives of everyone so much easier. Because in prior ERP implementations, it's such a struggle to try and get people to figure out, you know, what user profile should be associated with an individual, what profile should be associated with a user profile. It gets really complex, and it leads to long conversations. It's very inefficient. What Kelly has created here, she's gone through and she's identified all the different types of security roles, tailored it to particular security contacts, so that now all a security contact has to do is go down the list here and say, all right, well, for example, this user is someone with our financial information services group, so yeah, they need this access here. They're all set. So this form really simplifies to our security contacts going through what they can, in some cases, cannot grant access to when they receive these kind of requests. The five security checkpoints. When we created this process, we actually came up with five ways to make sure that the request for access to all this data is appropriate. It starts with the supervisor's approval. You check with your boss to make sure your boss is okay with you getting this access. The second, of course, is a security contact, reviewing and authorizing the access. The third, of course, is the data steward, the data owner, in terms of the data owner giving formal access privileges if it's, once again, kind of a global request for information. And we see that in places like student accounting and billing and financial aid. Then, of course, we have the request logged and reviewed by the security team. And then finally, as I mentioned before, the final fifth, the security check, is that processing complete, end user account is assigned, and then we notify the security contact, not the end user, but the security contact, that they've been granted access. So we've had a lot of success with this process since we rolled it out a little more than a year ago. Benefits have included, we took multiple different legacy authorization processes, we combined them all into one, which reduced our workload significantly. In the process of doing that, too, we eliminated end-user confusion. We had a lot of faculty members and staff out there getting confused in terms of, well, I need access to student records, so I thought I had to go through this and talk to this person, and then I need access to student financial information over here, and I had to talk to someone else and get different approvals. That all went away when we standardized on this process. And, of course, made processing requests more efficient for us, too. It really was kind of a one-stop shopping solution. You go to one place to get your access. You don't have to go to multiple places. It's just one place. It definitely helped ensure that data access matched the employee's job responsibilities. It definitely stopped attempts at unauthorized data access. By the way, most of the bad requests we get are not really malicious in nature. It's just people not knowing better that they can't have this kind of access per se. So the process really kind of helps capture those people. And because you have a localized security contact, it gives the security contact the opportunity to explain the process, the rules, and ensure that folks have the appropriate access or not. Best of all, our auditors love this process. We've had Deloitte & Touche, which is our external auditors, as well as our internal audit group, review this process for nearly 2 years now, and we've gotten nothing but compliments. I think in part because even in the business world, they don't see this kind of robust authorization process in place. In fact, it's kind of fun to watch the new IT auditors come in. They just assume, oh, it's a university. They don't have good controls in place. And then they see this, and they leave, and they rave about us to their other clients, to their colleagues as well. So it's given us a lot of good publicity. And it really helps reaffirm that, yeah, universities can do and do a good job with security controls and protecting sensitive information. Just two final slides. This is the metrics I mentioned before about authorization requests. What you're looking at here is when we first went live back in 2005. This is right around the go-live time, and then the number of requests we had to deal with were just shot through the roof. We were dealing, I think, with peaks about 700 requests a month. And then it shot down a little bit, stabilized a little bit, and now we're averaging about 100 to 200 requests a month. But because of federated authorization, we were able to deal with this initial peak, and we can continue to deal with these peaks with regards to waves of requests, particularly like when new functionality gets rolled out. We can handle that and handle it effectively. Final slide. Federated authorization. Now, I've been talking about our student record system, our PeopleSoft system. What we've been focusing on now, just in the past year, is taking this process and extending it to other systems as well. So in addition to getting access to our PeopleSoft system, you can also use federated authorization to get access to our student data warehouse system. In fact, it's the exact same process. You fill out the exact same form for either environment. And right now, we're in the process of rolling out federated authorization for our student data mart systems, too, which has worked out very well so far. Well, that's what I was hoping to share with you today. Hopefully, you found that of value. Was that helpful? All right, great. Nick, how are we doing on time? Five minutes? Okay. Great. How about like 3 to 5 minutes of questions, if anyone has any questions they'd like to ask? Yes, sir. How do you get the security officers buy-in for this process? Well, that was easy. I'm the information security officer, so my buy-in was easy. Oh, with the security contacts. How'd you get to the buy-in? Well, they didn't really have a choice because we did go to the deans and department heads, explain this process to them, and then ask them to designate someone with those rules as to what type of individual should be an ideal security contact, and they designated that person. It really hasn't been that big of a deal because for a security contact, the burden is usually not all that great. You're not dealing with requests every single day. I don't know, Kelly. I mean,
it was kind of mandated from the top, coming from the top down and having the buy-in then wasn't really that difficult. At first, people were like, oh, it's going to be a lot of extra work. But once we had training, we went through everything with them. We sent out emails, sample information, got everyone together on a couple different occasions to walk through the process. And we're available. If they have questions or issues, they definitely come to us. But it really was an easy rollout. We didn't have that much resistance at all from the security contacts.
So the second question is, have we considered putting the forms up online? Oh, like an automatic workflow process. Right. Yeah, I'm very interested in implementing an automatic workflow solution. It's something we're looking at right now, but nothing solid as of yet. But it certainly is a strategic direction we want to take the process to. Yes, in the back. So just to kind of generalize that question, does it mean the university doesn't have to comply with PCI because we're not storing credit card numbers in our PeopleSoft system? Long story short, we do need to be compliant with PCI because we do store credit card information on other systems. We just don't have credit card numbers on our PeopleSoft system nor in our data warehouse system. So we don't have to have specific PCI controls in those boxes. But for our data center as a whole, and for other systems that do have credit card information stored on them or are used to transfer credit card information, yes, they have to be PCI compliant, and they are PCI compliant. Once again, everyone, thanks so much for coming here today. If you have any other questions, come on up. We'd be more than happy to talk with you.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Outsourced hosting of multi-format digital media content is available from Real's own CDN, the Real Broadcast Network. Information at rbn.com.